With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. I am always am Jack Pelling, and with me is...
Robin Allender. Hello.
How are you doing, Robin? Have you had a good week?
Yeah, it's been all right. It's been good. We're very pleased to see the podcast doing well. The episode with Alice seems to have gone down very well.
Yeah, absolutely thrilled. Top of most of the poppermost, which is an absolute thrill. Might only be the music charts, but it's a start. We're really thrilled with everyone listening and the lovely messages that we've got and stuff, and lots of nice ratings. Only one bad one. I think that's pretty good going.
Oh, really? Have we had a bad one?
We had one. I think we got 44 5-star reviews and 1 2-star review.
Oh, really? Did they say anything?
They didn't say anything, no. They just checked the button and scarpered off into the night. But you can't please everyone all the time, as they say.
I hate that on YouTube videos. Whenever you upload something to YouTube, it's just the little thumbs down reaction. What's that for? You know, it's just you impress thumbs down, and it's like, oh, here's something I've worked on for like a month, and that thumbs down will really, really rattle around the old brain box in the middle of the night.
Yeah, it's a real weekend ruiner.
It really is.
But you know, we're over it. I mean, yeah, we're overwhelmed by all the lovely messages on our social media and some emails and stuff. And so, thought I'd just read out one email that was really nice from Callum O'Grady, who we won't go to Steve Wrighty in reading out praise for ourselves, slapping each other on the back, so I'll miss out the bit where he talks about how brilliant the show is, but not my words, the words of Callum O'Grady. He says, I remember clearly as a kid riling through my parents' record collection and finding the two classic Beatles collections, The Red and The Blue. As a kid who hadn't listened yet to them, my interest was first pricked by looking at the same guys in the same place years apart and how they had changed physically. Then it was a case of putting the records on and hearing how the sound too changed over that period. Amazing. Thanks for making me think of that after all these years. And then another good recommendation about Louis Theroux on Adam Buxton's podcast, which is a great Beatles conversation as well. So there we go, another person who the Red and the Blue albums is is the entry
Someone
point.
Sent me a photo of you know, the guy from Silence of the Lambs, Buffalo Bill.
Yes, yeah.
Sort of dangling the dog.
Right, okay, I thought that's not the scene I thought you were going to mention.
No. But it's like superimposed on the balcony of the Red album, him looking down into the well. That was good, yeah. Yeah, I had a nice message from Andy Zuck, who, you know, a full disclosure, is a friend of mine, but he said, listening to the first episode, you've absolutely nailed the detail sweet spot on this. I always find podcasts on subjects close to my heart. Disappointingly superficial, but loving this. I was also starting to think I was the only person on Earth who isn't that bothered for Rubber Soul, but thanks for fighting the good fight on the White album. So, thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
I mean, that's okay to read out things friends have said, isn't it?
Yeah, perfect. I've got a few from my mum, and it says, you say a lot. That was my original feedback from my dad when he listened to my first podcast I did. So if you do want to get in touch, we love to hear about your Beatles entry points and stuff. So you can email us at jack@homespunsounds, or you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact. So you've been listening to a bit of the Flaming Pie reissue this week, is that...
Yeah, it's good. It stands up pretty well. And I think we were sort of messaging about this earlier. We're getting a kind of Proustian rush of late 90s kind of, you know, Light Lunch with Mel and Sue, TFI Friday, Paul McCartney's Flaming Pie coming out. I was doing my GCSEs when that came out. But that song, Young Boy, is really, really good. That, like, really...
Yeah,
is up there with as a classic McCartney melody. I think it's really, really good song.
I think it's got some slightly dodgy lyrics in the middle eight.
Right, really? What do you mean? Problematic?
No. They're just a bit sort of lame.
Oh, right.
It's
right.
Like, fine love. It's like a proper understanding or something like that.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
just a bit. You know,
I always like that. Do you like Van Morrison?
Yeah.
I love how when when Van Morrison is on form, no one can touch him, obviously.
Yeah.
But lyrically, I love, you can really tell it when he's just given up.
Yeah.
With some of the fillers on some of the albums.
Yeah. Isn't it an apocryphal story where he had to bash off a load of albums because he was contractually obliged to do this?
Oh, yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah.
But have you heard those recordings?
They're very, very strange. Yeah, he had to sort of bash them out around the time he did Astral Weeks, I think.
Mm.
Yeah, really odd. One's called Bouncing Ball or something like that. But I'm talking, there's an album, one of the, about 1990, album called Enlightenment, which is brilliant. I love that album. But there's a real filler track, and the lyrics to the middle eight just go, "We made it through the spring, made it through the summer, made it through the fall, and we made it through the winter." He's just listing
that's
the
a
seasons.
Bit of a back of a fag packet one, I think.
Yeah, it really is.
But it's interesting listening back to that for the first time, because I hadn't listened to it for probably, I don't know, at least 20 years, and I just suddenly had this vision of him playing it on TFI Friday in 1997, where he's got the TV screens in the background of him sort of playing the drums and doing his little and then I remembered the interview, and I realised that I must have had it on VHS or something, because I remembered the interview word for word.
Really?
I hadn't watched it for
it's an interesting production on that album, because it's sort of, it's not, you'd think they would be trying to kind of cash in and making it quite Britpop-y, but it doesn't sound anything like that.
It's very Jeff Lynne-y,
Yeah, it's very Jeff Lynne, Who's actually on it, isn't he?
Yeah, he does a lot of the backing vocals and stuff. But I think they, because, to get a little nerdy factoid in there, it was going to be released in, I think, 95 or something, but EMI didn't want him releasing any solo material while the anthology stuff was going out.
Right, okay.
So they had to sit on it for a while, and I think that was why, because it was produced by George Martin and Jeff Lynne. So I think there is a theory that he went to try and make it a little bit more colourful and ELO-y.
Right,
make it a bit less Beatles-y.
That's interesting. I also was listening to Flowers in the Dirt this week. So because we might have him on, actually, but
Paul McCartney.
Sorry,
that's
let me
good news, just, you didn't tell me.
I've got a good friend, Holly McIntosh, whose dad is Robbie McIntosh, who played guitar with the Pretenders, but also played with Paul in that era, so it'd be great to have him on at some point. He's a brilliant guitarist, kind of very of its time, quite chorusy guitar, I love a bit of chorus. My friend sent me a video of Paul promoting that album, and there's a little clip of Holly in New York when she was five testing out the microphone and a sound check.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's good if you know my friend Holly, but
it's just good to have a photo, isn't it?
Yeah.
Good stuff. So, moving on to today's episode, we've got a fascinating chat with Dr. Susie Gage.
Yeah, this was a brilliant chat, wasn't it? So, Susie Gage is a podcaster, an epidemiologist, a psychologist, an author. She's and a musician, so very multi-talented. She's most well known probably for doing her podcast, Say Why to Drugs with Scroobius Pip. It's a brilliant podcast which kind of deconstructs the myths around drugs, and each episode is about a different drug, from coffee all the way up to DMT, basically. They talk about a variety of drugs and the effects they have and the myths surrounding them. So it's very, very informative and interesting. And she's just published this year a book accompanying the series called Say Why to Drugs, which is worth getting your hands on. But she missed kind of a lot of the publicity because of COVID and stuff. But do get a copy of it.
Immediately.
And read it. Yeah. But Susie's an old friend of mine because we lived in Bristol together in the noughties. And so she's a very good friend, and she used to play in a band called You and the Atom Bomb, and we did gigs together, and so it was kind of interesting chatting about music and music from that time as well, and her kind of relationship with the Beatles and other musical acts.
Yeah, there's also some really fascinating stuff about the links between drugs and creativity, specifically John Lennon's relationship with LSD and later heroin. And whether or not that's a help or a hindrance.
Yeah.
And then she talks a little bit about life in Liverpool. She's a senior lecturer at Liverpool University, so she gives us a little guide of the Beatles tourist spots to, the ones to see and the ones to avoid. So we really hope you enjoy this episode. As always, you can follow us on social media at Personal Beatles, or go to personalbeatles.com if you this is your first episode and you haven't heard the previous ones with mine and Robin's Personal Beatles and Ellis James's last week. So we'll be back at the end, and please enjoy Dr. Susie.
So, Susie Gage, welcome.
Thanks very much.
And first question, what's an epidemiologist?
Well, I think actually COVID has slightly helped with people understanding what it is, because there's lots of sort of people are being accused of being armchair epidemiologists and that kind of thing. But I'm a proper like office chair epidemiologist, although I don't actually do anything to do with infectious diseases. So the type of epidemiologist that's being talked about on the news is not really what I am. But broadly, the word epidemiologist comes from epidemic, and it's about looking at sort of population level data to try and understand patterns in particularly health. But I'm not interested in infectious diseases. I'm interested in understanding the links between recreational drug use and mental health in particular.
Cool. Can I, I've got my London Review of Books here. do you know the writer Patricia Lockwood? She wrote a brilliant book called Priest Daddy, which is about her dad, who's a Catholic priest.
Oh, I've not read anything, but I've heard of her, yeah.
She's brilliant. She actually got COVID. And in this week's LRB, she wrote about the experience of it. But her dad, this is brilliant. I thought you'd like this anyway. This is her dad. "Are you questioning my knowledge of epidemiology?" he shouted at my sister in the course of one conversation. "She is a research pharmacist. He is a Catholic priest." She had asked him whether it was safe to administer communion to people on the tongue. He countered that it was the only safe way. It should be stated that my father, in the early days of lockdown, was in his absolute glory. The only thing he's ever wanted to do in his entire life is hold a secret mass that is also illegal. And for a month or two, he got his chance, operating through the loophole that a priest was allowed to celebrate the rite himself. And if he left the doors open and people happened to come in and witness it, and if a crumb of the body of Christ happened to fall off his fingertips directly into their mouths at the opportune moment, he could hardly be held responsible.
That's amazing.
But you must have come across kind of fairly idiotic opinions during this crisis. And have you been drawn into that debate on Twitter or anything?
To begin with, when it all first started and there were lots of people giving their opinion, I felt really underqualified as a sort of, everyone was going, oh, everyone thinks they're an epidemiologist. And I was like, well, I actually am an epidemiologist and I'm not qualified to talk about this. So, you know, it's not even all, hashtag not all epidemiologists. Yeah. But it's so easy to sort of read a few articles and think that you know what's going on, but actually it's so complicated. It's such a new, like trying to understand a new virus is incredibly hard. And even what we know about other coronaviruses is quite different. So the common cold is a coronavirus, but it's not really anything like COVID or SARS-CoV-2 or whatever it's called. And sort of, yeah, even that, like, what's the difference between the name of the virus and the name of the disease that the virus causes and all of this kind of thing? It's all got very kind of confusing. And obviously there's a lot of bad faith actors getting involved in this who have their own opinions to push for whatever reason that they do. And so actually navigating it all is really difficult. And I guess that, like, one of the things that I do is kind of science communication and public engagement, and this is probably the time that I should be doing more of that, but to be honest, it's just the last thing I want to do is add to the noise. And so unless I've got something really useful to say, I'm probably not going to say anything. Although having said that, with a colleague at work, we have started a podcast called Coping with COVID, which is for medical and nursing students who have been the group of young people, well, mostly young people, who've been fast-tracked into the NHS, who are volunteering in COVID wards and that kind of things while their degrees are sort of in a weird place. They were sort of fast-tracked into the NHS to help out.
Right.
And obviously that's incredibly stressful and difficult for them. So we've put together some resources about like how to manage your sleep, how to manage your alcohol intake, how to cope with grief and bereavement during this time when lockdown is having such an impact on those kind of things. So it's like something actually useful using my own knowledge base that I can do. And also I know how to edit a podcast together. So that's something kind of practical and helpful that I could do. And when lockdown first started, I kind of sat there going, oh God, I've got no motivation. I feel really overwhelmed. So it was really nice to have something sort of that felt like I was being useful to somebody.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's great.
Pretty much the same inspiration I had for this, but you could argue that it's slightly less useful.
I don't know. I mean, you could argue that, but I'm not sure I'd want to.
So as well as being an epidemiologist, you're also a very talented musician and a Beatles fan. So, and you're in Liverpool as well, which is another nice connection.
Yes, absolutely. You can't really escape the Beatles here. And I'm sure that's something that will feature throughout this conversation of how sort of impregnated into everything in Liverpool is Beatles things. I mean, I live one street away from Penny Lane. That's how Beatlesy that's pretty cool. I am.
Yeah, when I was up staying with you and we went to Penny Lane, you know, to get the obligatory photo and everything.
Oh, yeah.
I was really struck by, I mean, this is a very obvious point, I suppose, but just how it's such an ordinary street, you know. It reminds me of when I was in Belfast and I went to Cypress Avenue because of the Van Morrison connection, and you get there and it's like, oh, it's just a street, you know. But there's something, I think what's great about these places for the Beatles or for Van Morrison is they had some connection there. That's not obvious, but there's something, the magic of childhood is kind of connected with it. So when you go there, it's just a kind of street. But obviously, if you grow up there, you have this kind of spiritual connection there.
Yeah, I think it's Strawberry Field is kind of the same. Until very recently, it was just some red gates that sort of led to a bit of wasteland, basically. But a few months ago, actually, the new sort of Strawberry Field building was opened, and it's a kind of community center. I can't remember exactly who it's for. I think sort of disadvantaged or disabled children, I think. But that's very recently been opened. But until then, it was just these red gates that everyone had signed, and then next to it a big sign saying, do you want to buy some replica gates? Why not phone this number, kind of thing. So it's really, really underwhelming, I think is the word.
Yeah.
Can I just ask, Robin, what you were expecting to in Penny Lane?
Well, I don't know. Some kind of nurses selling poppies from a tray, you know, or something, you know. So I suppose just something, I suppose you expect to kind of be, have you ever been to Beamish? You know, the kind of antique village that's up north somewhere, where it's everything's, they tried to keep everything in the Industrial Revolution. You know, and there are people in costume or something. I suppose you expect some kind of grand
taxis.
Yeah.
did we go up the other end of Penny Lane? Because the end that I live near is the kind of, it's where the sign is that everyone has signed, including Paul McCartney signed.
Yeah, yeah.
But up
yeah.
the other end, there is the barber's is still there, and there's bank is there, although it's a charity shop now, and the bus shelter is there, although it's a sort of disused bistro now, which is quite strange.
Disused bistro.
Yeah, the church where Paul's brother got married is there, and where Paul was a choir boy. You might be able to tell I've done, there's a Beatles taxi tour. I've done it 3 or maybe 4 times, I can't remember.
That's great.
Now. But every time someone comes to visit, they want to do it, and it's really fun. Yeah,
oh, that's great.
I've been in Reading for lockdown, which doesn't have quite as spectacular or notorious Beatles connection. But even in Reading, I walked past this really crappy old pub in Caversham, and it had a blue plaque on the wall saying it was where the John and Paul played their only gig as the Nurk twins in 1960. And suddenly one of the most nondescript pubs in the south side of Reading became probably the most interesting place I went in the whole of
lockdown. Great.
So it doesn't take much magic dust to be sprinkled on a boring place.
There's a great... have you read White Noise by Don DeLillo? Do you know that book? There's a...
I think I read it years ago, but
there's a great bit in that which is about the world's most photographed barn. And it's just this place that everyone goes to take a photograph of. And it, because it's the most photographed barn, so it's this self-perpetuating thing. There's nothing special about the barn, but people go there. It kind of I'm always reminded of that when you go to one of these famous places, or when you go to see, like, if you ever see the Mona Lisa or something, it's just like, why am I actually here?
I know what it looks like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. The other thing I was going to say about Penny Lane is that that's strange odd magical sense that you feel in the song that is great. I think Ian McDonald points out about the fact that it's summer in the song, but then the nurse is selling poppies, which would make it November and things like that. There's all...
Yeah, and it's pouring with rain, which suggests it's like April. It could be. It's an everyday scene.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But you're right, when you listen to those songs, and kind of Strawberry Fields as well, they're proper summer. That was a summer single, a summer.
Yeah.
It was really evokes the kind of like summer of love, I guess. It was around that time, wasn't it? I don't know if it's exactly that year, but really, yeah, you immediately think like hot, and it's strange that how they're very jangly summery songs.
Yeah, but I suppose it's that kind of the childhood thing. Both of those songs.
Yeah.
Yeah, they evoke the childhood and the slightly unnervingness of childhood memories as well, of the kind of, it's like, I don't know, not quite, you know, there's something, it's very beautiful, but there's something else under the surface.
Being a child is a lot like being on acid, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was, you know, one of the things that would be really interesting to get your take on is the relationship that the Beatles, and especially John, had with drugs throughout their, you know, most creative years. And, you know, we mentioned in previous podcasts about the, you know, their relationship with marijuana, which very much informed the Rubber Soul and Revolver. And then Revolver, they start getting it more into acid. And then, you know, it's absolutely soaks Sgt. Pepper, which is their most sort of creative and, you know, some would argue seminal record. And it's kind of that relationship with creativity and very, very strong mind-altering drugs is probably now something that, you know, you wouldn't get much of a pass for. But in the 60s, it seemed that it was almost sort of commendable. With 50 years of knowledge now, what would you say about the relationship between creativity and mind-expanding drugs?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I've got to be honest, I don't actually know that much about the Beatles and their drug taking, sort of, to talk about them specifically. I think that someone's written a book about it, which is apparently amazing, but I haven't read it, so that's no use to us in this conversation. But in general, this kind of idea of creativity and drugs kind of going hand in hand, I think is quite overstated. And the thing that's really difficult to get at is the causality. So are people creative because they take drugs, or are creative people more likely to explore mind-altering substances because of who they are? So actually the substance itself kind of doesn't really matter. It's the person was always that creative, and that's because of that, that's what's drawn them to use substances and to explore sort of their inner mind, I suppose. And the substance itself, does that particularly matter? I don't know. I think maybe back in the 60s, when there was this whole movement around sort of Timothy Leary and Turn On, Tune In, Drop Out, it was kind of a sort of pushback against what was politically, particularly in the US, what was going on. And a kind of a counterculture, a young people rebelling against their parents, and all of this kind of thing all combined together. So whether you actually had to take acid to experience the mind expansion that was going on in the movement as a whole, I'm not so sure you did. But I think that because the acid was kind of there and around, that people often did. But when people have researched sort of the links between creativity and drug use, drugs don't particularly make you creative while you're high. It's really, really hard to actually do things like write songs or that kind of thing. Or certainly ones that, when you listen back to them when you're sober, actually sound any good, rather than just sort of incredibly long and don't really go anywhere.
That was kind of my experience as a young person with musicians and, you know, dabbling in the odd jazz cigarette. Is that always at the time I thought, wow, this is incredible. This is incredible. I've got to record this. This sounds bloody fantastic. And then I'd listen back to it and it'd be an absolute toss. So I think it helps if you're John Lennon is probably the key.
Yeah,
exactly.
There's a great Thomas De Quincey, who wrote the book Confessions of an English Opium Eater in the 19th century. In both centuries, he wrote that
in the
book.
Past. No,
in the past, in your. He said something like, "If you work with bulls, you dream of bulls," or something like that, which is a bit unfair to people who work with bulls. But I think he was saying that you have to be inclined to be creative to experience the visionary, for want of a better word, element of drug taking. I think that's possibly true with the Beatles, isn't it? As you were saying, Jack, that you kind of it helped that he was John Lennon. But the thing I don't understand is, you know, with their drug intake in the 60s was that I think John Lennon was taking acid every day, which does not seem like a good idea.
So no, well, also it has a kind of tolerance where if you do take it immediately after you've just taken it, you won't experience any effect of it. The tolerance doesn't last for very long, but if you take it sort of immediately after you've just taken it, you won't experience anything. So maybe that's how he could get away with it, because he was taking it, but it was only having an effect every few days because of this tolerance.
Yeah. And there's certainly, as you said, the sense that in terms of the recorded music in the studio, I think there's only one time when they're recording one of the songs on Sgt. Pepper, maybe Getting Better, where John Lennon had to go up on the roof of Abbey Road to chill out.
Yeah, he thought the roof was on fire or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, but there's no sense that they're on drugs as they're playing the songs. Or, you know, because the song, yeah, as you say, otherwise the songs would kind of be
awful.
Quite...
Yeah.
Or well, badly played. And yeah. I mean, I guess there's so much mythologizing around drug use and music in particular as well, that actually probably... what actually happened, we're very unlikely to get the sort of true story of, like, really how much were they taking and how often and were they, like, real high in the studio. Like, it's very hard to sort of separate out the kind of myth from the truth.
Yeah, I think that's probably, I mean, certainly on Revolver, there's Tomorrow Never Knows in particular, there's a very strong influence of the Timothy Leary and the Tibetan Book of the Dead stuff. But you can't imagine that ever like crept its way into making that record, because it just sounds like the most meticulously played and produced record ever.
And also, Tomorrow Never Knows is like 2 minutes long. So it's like, if that was a proper drug song, then it would be 15 minutes long, you know?
Yeah, at least, yeah.
Yeah.
But then I suppose you do get all of the... Yeah, talking about his experiences with heroin as well later, when most people around him said that he managed to get away from acid and got disillusioned with the whole sort of Timothy Leary thing, and then sort of became more interested in heroin later on with his like Yoko Ono years, where that definitely had a detrimental effect on his sort of work ethic and stuff, but produced a record of, especially his first solo album and some of the stuff on the White Album. Where thematically it's about his sort of relationship with heroin, and that is when he was beginning to write much more sort of personally and viscerally. So that's a different argument, isn't it? It's like, oh, that experience was so intense that it pushed him into writing some of his most sort of personal work.
Yeah, but then I guess also lots of things had changed in his life as well. He was kind of more disillusioned with the Beatles as a whole, and when he met Yoko, obviously his life circumstances completely changed as well. So it's like other things were also happening in his life as well as changing his kind of drug of choice. But yeah, in terms of if you're going to regularly take an opioid that's kind of a real sort of depressant painkiller type of drug, then it's very hard to kind of to do things while you're intoxicated on it, even more so than acid probably.
So do you have a favourite Beatles period?
I don't know. I think I don't tend to... I'm not sort of meticulous in my knowledge of the Beatles, and I tend to just... I remember the Beatles before I know what about memory, if you know what I mean. They were always in my life. Like,
that's great. We had a guest on, Christian Madden, who said the same thing. He couldn't really remember...
I can't remember a time when I didn't listen to the Beatles.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, it really makes me think of childhood car journeys, and that was always, like, the best of the Beatles kind of albums being on. So you'd hear the whole kind of gamut of across the years, and I didn't really think about separating out, like, oh, that this belongs to this period and this belongs to that period. And so certainly as a child, it was very much just like, oh, I like the songs. I like singing along to the songs. I like the ones with the good harmonies. Mm. I think as I grew older, I started to know a bit more about like get into some deeper cuts, I suppose.
Yeah.
I was still not particularly like when I joined a band when I was sort of 16, 17, and we started off as a covers band and we played quite a few Beatles songs, and some of them I didn't know. Like we played I Want You, She's So Heavy, which I'd never heard before, and I was like, oh my God, this is the same band as the band that did Penny Lane and the band that did I Want to Hold Your Hand. What?
And wait, you were a covers band. I thought you, because so is this the formative years of you and the Atom Bomb.
We were called the Shades when we first started, and that's when we did things like play the Holmer Green Village Fete, where we were interrupted to announce that everything on the bric-a-brac stall was now 50 pence. Yeah. Back to the music, yeah. Kind of thing.
Fair, the yeah. Fire's on fire.
And our first ever gig, which was supporting Lindisfarne, which is quite a coup, really. But we were completely, I think we had one original song at that point, which sounded exactly like the Strokes. So you probably couldn't have told it was an original song.
And did you do weddings and things like that as a covers band? Or was it just more?
So they had done weddings before I joined. So they were already going with a different singer. And they did a wedding and it went so badly that I think they just, not because of them, but because they brought two friends with them for some reason. And the friends got incredibly drunk. And I'm not sure I should be telling this story on a podcast. But one of them started sort of dancing with the bride when they really probably shouldn't have been. This kind of thing. And so I think we sort of thought maybe that's not the way for us to go.
Right. I was going to say doing I Want You, She's So Heavy at a wedding.
At a wedding would be, I think they did.
Yeah.
Right.
And there were definitely some quite inappropriate songs. I think they did, might have done Suspicious Minds, which maybe it's not that inappropriate for a wedding, but Brian, our guitarist, used to sing Suspicious Minds and Love Me Tender in a proper kind of, like we did this record, we did a demo with someone who had a recording studio in their shed in their back garden in High Wycombe, and this guy was always talking about how raunchy Brian's voice sounded, this being a 17-year-old boy. Like with a very raunchy voice.
Quite odd. Yeah, that's brilliant. I just remembered I was going to say this in the Christian Madden episode, but talking, he told a story about how he got his dad Sergeant Pepper for Christmas, and I remembered talking about wildly inappropriate music that I once got. I knew my mum was into soul music, so I got my mum a Marvin Gaye album, and it was Let's Get It On. It was so weird. So yeah, you started it. You joined this band, and then. Did you all go to the same uni together, or did you kind of know?
No, we all went off to different unis, but that meant we had four gigs a term because we'd do one in London, one in Exeter, one in Bristol and one in Southampton.
Right,
sort of cool. Every term. So that would be the way we kind of met up. And then every summer, instead of going away anywhere, we'd spend the time writing and gigging. And once we went, all of us up to Scotland, we stayed with Brian's family who live up there and did a little tour of like Inverness and and a few other places up around there. We went and camped on the beach in Ullapool and that kind of thing. It was really, really lovely trip.
Yeah.
I felt so sorry. We stayed with Brian's aunt and uncle and just like made an absolute racket the whole time. They must have been delighted when we rocked up.
Fond mems. And so when I met you, you were all back in Bristol and you were playing as you and the Atom Bomb.
Yeah. So when Brian was our guitarist and he was studying medicine in Bristol. So when the rest of us finished our degrees, because he was still going, we all moved to Bristol. We're kind of, that's just what happened.
Cool.
And it was great. I mean, I didn't really know anything about Bristol, but it was a brilliant place to move to when you're 20, 21, 22.
Yeah. And so when I met you, it was around 2005, 2006.
Yeah, I moved in 2005. Yeah.
Right. And yeah, I just remember being blown away by seeing you guys play, because it was really precise and it was really silly and it was brilliant, brilliant pop music, but quite proggy and technical too. And we should just say to listeners that, sadly, that You and the Atom Bomb stuff is not online, which is...
It's not online, which is annoying, but I do have several hundred copies of both of our EPs. If anyone is interested in hearing, please do get in touch. I will post you them out, because they are taking up a substantial amount of cupboard space.
Yeah, well, we should definitely get a campaign to get them back online. But there's there is a Beatles-y influence in your stuff. Do you think that was a big part of your musical kind of world back then?
Yeah, definitely. We were all really into it. And when we were doing covers, there were a lot of Beatles covers in our set, from the sort of like Twist and Shout kind of thing through to the harmonies of I Want to Hold Your Hand, and then things like Dig a Pony we used to do, I Want You She's So Heavy. So it was a pretty broad Beatles spectrum in our set as well.
You've basically done the whole catalogue there in like four songs from beginning to end.
But I remember, we used to listen a lot to... What album is Dig a Pony on? Is that on Let It Be?
Let It Be, yeah.
So I'd never really listened to Beatles albums at that point. It had been sort of compilations. And so we used to listen to Let It Be quite a lot when we were... Because we all, there was a lot of driving involved in that band, because we all lived all over the place. Even before we went to uni, we lived quite far apart. So there was lots of driving to and from band practices and things like that. And also, when you're that age, I just think you're constantly listening to music anyway, aren't you?
Yeah.
And Let It Be is one that I think Brian lent me, and I was just like, oh, this is great. This is the kind of a bit of Beatles that I had. Those songs don't appear so much on compilations, I don't think. Yeah, they definitely felt quite new to me anyway. And
I mean, I don't particularly know Let It Be that well. It's one of the blind spots I have. So there's a lot of undiscovered stuff out there for
Paul hated it so much, it never got featured on much Apple endorsed best of stuff apart from the single, but famously Phil Spector's production stuff was the last straw in many ways. But I think it's a great record, actually. I really like it, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see whether, because they've been remastering all of the last few albums for the 50th anniversaries, and this is the year of that Let It Be was released, but I think they'll probably give it a miss because George Martin wasn't involved in it, which is a bit of a shame.
But the film's coming out this year, right?
It's been pushed back a year, actually. Peter Jackson is remaking the very famous film with the where the aborted project of making a film that became, you know, just a succession
doing it in
of
a
arguments.
Peter Jackson kind of way, where there's 3 hours just on the first verse of Let It Be, and then
I think Andy Serkis is playing a CGI Ringo. It clocks in at 7 hours.
So Beatles films is something that I hadn't really seen until more recently, but when I started going out with Doug, I always really, really liked the Beatles, but somehow I ended up with a best friend and a nearly husband who were like two of the world's biggest Beatles fans, and in particular Paul McCartney fans. So
can we just explain who Doug is for the
Yes, listeners? So Doug's my fiancé. Weird word, he's a folk musician who plays under the name Jim Murray, and we met in Bristol probably around the same time I met you, actually, Robin. And all of us were on this music forum with lots of other people, and that's kind of how, when I first moved to Bristol, how I got to know people. And and we've been together for 7 or 8 years now. Not long after we started going out, I think it was when one of the films had been remastered and it was showing at the Watershed. What's the one with the guy from Steptoe and Son in it as
Hard
Paul's granddad? Hard Day's
amazing.
Night had just
he's
been...
He's very clean,
And that, so we went to see, for Doug's birthday, we went to see that at the Watershed. And I was like, oh, these films are really good. And they just completely passed me by. So since then, we've watched them all. And I'm completely obsessed with the Ruttles as well, which I don't know whether you're sort of allowed to talk about the Ruttles on the podcast about the Beatles.
We haven't talked about the Ruttles on this podcast yet, I don't think, but I'm obsessed, or I was at the age of about 12 or 13, obsessed
with
the Ruttles.
Well, I love the Ruttles, but I'm also a huge fan of Bonzo Dog. Like, that's is which is also Neil Innes.
Yeah, Neil Innes is an absolute songwriting genius. Yeah, and the fact that he could write Lennon and McCartney songs that didn't yet exist, that don't sound... I like, this is a bit podcast inception, but there's an amazing episode of the Rule of Three podcast about the Ruttles.
And
what they point out that I sort of hadn't thought about, but they're spot on, is that none of them sound like one particular Beatles song. They all sound like lots of like another song that would have been on that album, or, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
They're like, so well observed.
Yeah. They kind of allude to different songs and things. Yeah. Not, I mean, Cheese and Onion is obviously Day
in the Life. Yeah, I mean, so they definitely have core elements that are like a particular song, but they're not. And apparently, that's how Neil Innes did it, by not going back and listening to too much Beatles before he wrote them, and so that they weren't direct sort of rip-offs. They were far more, and they're so, and it's so loving as well. It's obvious that they're massive. I mean, the fact that George Harrison is in it and funded a lot of it.
Totally. That's brilliant. I mean, one of my favourite memories of my dad was he played me Gorilla by Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. I think he played it for me and my brother, and we were just, it was just one of those moments where I just couldn't breathe because I was laughing so much. You know, the jazz, disgusting, hot, delicious, cold song and things like that. But there's a song on there called The Equestrian Statue. Do you know that song? By Neil Innes. And it is just basically just, it could be on Village Green Preservation Society. It's like that good a song. And it's just, it's really funny as well.
A lot of that stuff is up there because they were around towards the very end of the Beatles, weren't they? Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. And Paul at that point especially was getting into his sort of pastiche stuff, much to the annoyance of the rest of the band, I think. But they definitely, there is ones that could sound like they're sort of Paul McCartney, especially like in stuff off Ram and things. But those Ruttles records are just so well recreated. The effort that has gone into them when you watch them back now, especially, I mean, I've been quite saturated in Beatles and stuff. And we were talking to Guy Chambers the other day about their production techniques. And you can tell that, actually, that's sort of, they've used Vary Speed to just notch that up a tiny bit on Cheese and Onions to give it that sort of slightly jangly sound. And it's like they've, you know, it must have cost them an amazing amount of money to make that film.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When we first met in Bristol, that was a very... It was a really interesting time in Bristol. There was lots of really good music going on. And I was going to talk a bit about Gravenhurst a bit, because I used to play in the band Gravenhurst. And what you mentioned about, we used to listen to a lot of music on tour and things like that. And I was kind of struggling to... Nick's Talbot, his mum, I remember, is a huge Beatles fan, and named... Paul, his brother, after Paul McCartney. But I was trying to think of some things about Nick and the Beatles. And I remember one of the things was we were listening to Revolver on the tour bus, and he thought it was really kind of funny stroke silly that they kind of double tracked everything. And it made sense because lots of Nick's recordings were very sparse, you know.
Yeah.
I kind of could. Have you got any? Does anything spring to your mind about Nick and the Beatles? Is that a kind of very broad question?
Not really. Like, I always thought he was a little bit scathing about them. I think probably because he even more than me, like, had a childhood that was entirely saturated with the
Beatles.
Yeah,
totally. And I think, do you know Gravenhurst's music, Jack?
No, I don't think so.
Nick was a really good friend of ours, and he was in a great band. I was in a band with him called Gravenhurst, which was a kind of folk-inspired band that became more kind of shoegazy and indie. And Nick sadly died in 2014, which is very sad and very tragic. And we're kind of, yeah, I suppose since then there's been a lot of time for thinking about Nick and what he would have thought of the strange times we're in now. But I mean, he's obviously, and he's also been such a huge influence on the way I think about music and things. So when we started this podcast, I was kind of thinking about what Nick would, have to say about the Beatles.
He'd have been a great guest for sure.
Yeah. But you're quite right. There is that kind of thing where a lot of Gravenhurst music is, it's quite dark. And I think there's a sort of thing where I think he wanted to, the Beatles were maybe too cozy for him or something like that.
Yeah, although having said that, like, he, I would say, was maybe not directly influenced, but certainly used to listen to a lot of people like Elliot Smith, who themselves were massively influenced by the Beatles.
Yeah, that's a very
so
good
I think
point.
It's that you're always only two steps away from the Beatles with whatever you're listening to.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
But like Elliot Smith is someone I've been thinking about a lot recently in terms of like how influenced by the Beatles a lot of his music is and how amazing it is because of that and like his incredible cover of Because that's really sort of faithful that was it used in American Beauty I think Doug made a playlist the other day that was all songs that were quite clearly influenced by the Beatles and it was really really fun putting it together and trying to think of like all sorts of different eras of the Beatles
and
music that's been related to that. But we were also talking about, I don't know whether you know the Left Banc,
who were this
amazing 60s band, well 60s 70s band, but their sort of hits don't necessarily sound that much like the Beatles, but there's on their kind of best of album, as you get further away from sort of Pretty Ballerina and Walk Away Renee, you get loads that are really Beatlesy, and some of them are really Ringo-y as well.
Really?
They've got some real real Ringo songs that are kind of hilarious.
The rich seam of Don't Pass Me By. I love the Pretty Ballerina, and it sounds like an Elliot Smith song from the 60s, doesn't it? But I think the great thing about Elliot Smith and the thing that Nick liked a lot as well was that kind of, I think just the kind of, the idea of the craft of songwriting, I think, which is what Elliot Smith is really good at, the kind of intricacy of the arrangements and...
And making something in sparse and intricate at the same time, which is
definitely
quite a skill.
Yeah. And Neil Finn as well, Crowded House, I think is very Beatlesy.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I didn't know very much Crowded House until recently, but we went to see Neil Finn in Edinburgh at the beginning of last year, and it was kind of the Neil Finn family band, so his wife and his children are in the band, and it was such a fun evening.
Yeah, there's an album Neil Finn did with his son Liam Finn.
Yeah.
Came out a couple of years ago. That's absolutely brilliant. I love it. And it's
it was a really, really great show. Yeah.
Do you have a controversial Beatles opinion? So is there a kind of a famous song that you really hate or an album that you think is overrated?
I'm not sure this is a particularly controversial Beatles opinion, but Matthew Street in Liverpool, where the Cavern was, is one of the most awful roads in the whole country, and I hate it.
Yeah. I think that's a good one.
But I actually think probably quite a lot of Beatles fans would probably agree with me.
Right.
Like, when we came to Liverpool to look for somewhere to live, like I got offered the job here in sort of March, but I wasn't starting it until January, so we had quite a while of sort of knowing we were moving up here from Bristol. To plan, so we came up for a weekend and like did a load of sort of house hunting and exploring areas of Liverpool where we might want to live and that kind of thing, and we stayed in town, and we were like, oh yeah, we'll have to go and see Matthew Street, because I think Doug had been when he was a tiny child, but I'd never been, and it's just hideous. It's right. like sort of Stag and Hen Party Central. Right. It's all kind of awful bars that are like blaring, admittedly the Beatles, but still like flyers of sort of women getting free kind of thing to all these bars. And the cavern isn't even in the same place as the actual cavern was. They've kind of, built a sort of replica of it, which is fine. Like it's like the cavern was, but the street is horrible, and it's a shame because the street's got loads of other interesting things about it as well. It's sort of it's quite linked into the KLF. As well, and all these sort of talk of ley lines and Carl Jung saying that Liverpool is the pool of life and all of this kind of stuff. It's really interesting, but it's a really horrible place.
Yeah. What's the venue on the same street that kind of Echo and the Bunnymen and all that used to play?
Oh, Eric's, was it?
Right, I think. And that's not there anymore.
No. And even if it was, you wouldn't want to go to it.
Would the equivalent of Bristol be like the harbour side, I'm guessing? That kind
Yeah, completely. It's just the sort of touristy, towny, go and get absolutely leathered place.
Sounds good.
Which doesn't have anywhere nice to eat or drink.
But
everyone goes there.
So as an adoptive Liverpudlian, what would you say is the best Beatles landmark to see?
Oh, well, you go like Eleanor Rigby's grave. That's pretty good, which is opposite the hall where John and Paul first met.
Right.
So that there's kind of when you do the tour, there's sort of everything is kind of things are much closer together than you might realize. And like the fact that those two sites are opposite each other, sort of Eleanor Rigby being towards the much later Beatles, but is opposite the site where they literally first met when they were teenagers. And actually we did the last time I did the Beatles taxi tour was in July, when like July last year, and it happened to be the day that they met, which we hadn't realized when we did it. And then when we went into the hall, there was sort of a cake sale and weird stuff going on in the hall because it was the day that they met. But it was really like, it's amazingly low key. You'd think there'd be a sort of multi-million pound industry around the Beatles.
Yeah.
And there are things like there's the Magical Mystery Tour bus, which you can go on, which is really good. And these taxi tours and things, but the things themselves, like Penny Lane, as you say, is just a road. And, this hall is just a hall, and I sound a bit like Scroobius Pip now, but things, they're just
a band.
Exactly. The Beatles are just a band.
Have you ever seen the TripAdvisor page for the zebra crossing on Abbey Road? Because it's just loads of people going, "This it's just a zebra crossing." I was, giving it one star. And
what were you expecting? That the Beatles walk across it every half hour on the hour.
And like the Cavern Club, it's not even the same zebra crossing.
Yeah. Oh, isn't it?
No, it's about 10 metres down the road.
Having said that, like, all these things are quite low-key, like, I have seen Paul McCartney.
Oh, what, just wandering around?
Well, not quite just wandering around, but when he did the carpool karaoke thing with this wasn't actually the time I saw him, but when he did that, he must have driven past our house because you can see in the film, and there were like I'm in a Facebook local group called Penny Lane Gossip, and there were sort of pictures of him appearing sort of on the docks first of all, but then leaning against the bus shelter at the top of Penny Lane, and I had literally just been out for a run, and I was like, I must have just run past Paul McCartney. I mean, and James Corden, but, whatever. But but then a couple of weeks after that, so he's the patron, I think, of LIPPA, which is the Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts. And so he does their graduation. And I hadn't really realised it was the same day, but I'd been at work and I was quite tired. So instead of walking home, I decided to get the bus. And I left work a bit early and I went and stood at the bus stop and I looked, and the bus stop is outside the Liverpool Philharmonic. And there were some, not very many, but some of those silver crowd control railings up around the back of the Phil. And I said to someone at the bus stop, oh, do you know what that's about? And they're like, oh yeah, the LIPPA graduation is in there and Paul McCartney's in there. So I was like, shall I get the bus or shall I just shall I just wait and see Paul McCartney? So I was like, well, I don't need to get home for anything. I've left work early. So I crossed the road and sort of stood with maybe like 25 other people, not very many, and like, and that. And then about 10 minutes after that, he came out, and genuinely, it was incredible. And like, I was not expecting to feel overwhelmed by seeing Paul McCartney, but it really genuinely was like, wow, that is Paul McCartney. Yeah, and like, amazing. I was trying to take a picture and my hands were shaking, and it was like, I did not expect myself to have that reaction, but it really was incredible to see him sort of,
yeah,
the other side of a little alleyway, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was amazing. He came out, he sort of mimed playing the guitar, and, woo, like genuinely did all of the cliche things, yeah, that you expect Paul thumbs McCartney up to do, like, yeah, yeah, awkward dad kind of wacky macca thumbs aloft, yeah, properly, yeah, lived up to that. And in my pictures he looks like an old woman because that's what Paul McCartney looks like now. And, but yeah, it was that's the kind of thing that happens in Liverpool.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, things like that genuinely do happen.
Yeah, because I once went on a stag do to Rockfield Studios, where Queen recorded Bohemian Rhapsody, and loads, mm-hmm, of bands played there. And the guy doing the tour was just so funny, because he was trying to kind of manufacture these connections. So it's like, Coldplay came here, right? And I'm not saying anything, right? But what colour is that wall? It's like, yellow. Yeah, you see?
Yeah.
And things like that. And it was brilliant. Yeah.
I imagine there's a lot of that around in Liverpool.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. This is the bench where he might have actually sat.
Yeah.
The Beatles taxi tour is very much like that. And actually, I don't know whether you know, but right, there's been an awful lot of controversy over the past month or so about Penny Lane and its name. Mm. Because James Penny was a slave trader.
Really? And really?
And in the Liverpool Museum of Slavery, Penny Lane is one of the streets that is listed as being named after a slave trader. And when you go on the taxi tour, they tell you this and that kind of thing, and say that actually a few years ago, Liverpool had a big campaign to rename all of the streets that were named after slave traders. And it actually got really, really far through until someone realised that that would mean they'd have to rename Penny Lane. And someone graffitied... Right. Mm. Graffitied all the Penny Lane signs last month, I guess, after all the Black Lives Matter campaigns and the pulling down of the Colston statue in Bristol and that kind of thing. But since then, there's been a lot of effort to find out whether that's actually the case or not. And consensus is quite split, and there's a lot of people who think actually it was called Penny Lane because it cost a penny to, like, it was a toll road or something like that.
Right.
So the James Penny didn't live anywhere near Penny Lane. Whereas when I went on the Beatles taxi tour, I'm sure that I was told at least
did
one time.
Did a Beatles fan discover that fact about the penny? Yeah. It's a toll road.
Yeah, actually. Yeah. Well, to be honest, that was my kind of initial. I was really sceptical, like, oh, of course someone, like, you can prove anything with fact, you know. Of course, it's someone's found some way of saying it wasn't that. But actually, the evidence isn't very strong. And when the Slavery Museum were asked sort of, well, why do you have a Penny Lane sign in? And they were like, well, we don't actually have any direct evidence to suggest that the road was definitely named after James Penny. So it's complicated, but that's been a lot of conversation in the Penny Lane gossip Facebook group.
Yeah.
Maybe we could tear down the signs now and then have a competition to have a public vote of your favourite Beatles song to rename the road after. Yeah.
Maxwell's Silver Hammer
could
Road.
Just get Penny Lane to go to the top.
Yeah, but that's what's interesting about it, because the whole counter argument is, oh, you know, it's revising history. But the whole point of, and what's good about all this, is you're actually engaging with history and looking at these reasons
and learning things and finding these things out.
Yeah,
are you saying they should rip down the signs for Penny Lane? There was a huge problem of people stealing the road signs, so they've had to make them the sort of quite ugly plastic ones now. Because when they had the nice metal, like wrought iron ones that were painted white, people would just steal them constantly.
I would probably be one of those people, to be fair.
When Paul McCartney signed, so that's the one that everyone signs is actually painted on a wall, And that's the one Paul McCartney signed. But after he signed it, people started trying to chip the paintwork off. So they've had to cover it in a perspex protective thing because people want a bit of the Beatles.
Yeah. The Eleanor Rigby thing, I always thought Eleanor Rigby was they got the name out of the phone book, but then coincidentally there was an Eleanor Rigby in the graveyard. Is that completely
rubbish?
Well,
so this is what they tell you in great detail.
Okay.
Is how, Paul was supposedly sitting in a car park in Bristol.
Yeah.
Whoa. And he saw, I can't remember what it was that he...
Rigby's the butcher.
Yeah. And there was reading a paper and there was Eleanor, someone in the paper.
Yeah.
And the taxi tour driver's kind of take on it is that was Paul trying to protect the churchyard protect the gravestone from awful people who would steal it, kind of thing, basically, people who want a bit of the Beatles. Mm. Because the thing about Eleanor Rigby's grave is that she was married, but her gravestone is in her maiden name, and so was buried along with her name. So there's sort of a few things about it that help the tale to be told that suggest that, and it is a bit of a coincidence that it's literally opposite the place they met, kind of thing.
Yeah.
However, yeah, that's not what Paul says, and given Paul wrote the song, who are you going to believe? A slightly racist taxi driver? Or,
It was originally going to be a Father McCartney as well, wasn't it? It was going to be his own name, but he changed it to Father McKenzie. I think that might have been something he got from a phone book, McKenzie. And apparently Ringo came up with darning his socks in the night. So there you go.
Yeah. I think that's such a difference in the songwriting. Like Paul McCartney will just beg, steal and borrow any words to fit his lovely melodies and stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas, John's is all works as kind of prose, isn't it? When you see them, there's some in the British Library where there's quite a lot of Beatles lyrics in there, and some of it, I mean, and including Penny Lane, is just like psychedelia was like a good excuse to fall back on when you could just allowed you to write nonsensical lyrics.
Yeah, but that's something I think there's. I mean, Eleanor Rigby's got that great line about keeping the face that she keeps in the jar by the door. It's like that is brilliant, isn't it? I mean, that's very poetic, isn't it?
And I mean, some of John's lyrics are incredibly questionable in terms of sort of misogyny and that sort of thing. It's like the other day someone was talking about what was the worst Beatles song, and I think they'd said Obladi Oblada, and I said I think it might be Run for Your Life, actually.
Well, we talked about that in the first podcast, but I've sort of read around it afterwards. I'm not, and this isn't defending it, but John Lennon, it was like meant to be deliberately playing that role, which is not a defense.
Kind of hope so. Yeah. And I think, but then he also wrote Jealous Guy, which is a little bit sort of holding up his hands to what then came out about his past and sort of. It's not really a good enough excuse, actually.
No,
and sorry, I was jealous.
Yeah, and getting better, as I used to be mean with my.
Yeah.
What's the line in that? I can't remember.
I used to be mean to my woman. I beat her and kept her apart from the things that she loved.
Yeah, that's not great,
nice
is it?
John.
Sorry.
But he had a very funny way of like reevaluating his like nastier, more acerbic lyrics sort of later on by saying his excuse was always, but it's about me, you know, I'm attacking me or whatever, you know. Mm. And, he would say, I was writing about the worst aspects of myself. I didn't actually mean it type thing. And then, it's quite amazing that someone who wrote Run for Your Life can write like a woman is the N-word of the world about 6 years later or whatever. But he did tend to change his mind quite a lot.
I mean, it's important to learn and develop as a person.
So one of the other stock questions that we have is considering the Beatles were so good, and the story surrounding them is so amazing, and the narrative is full of so many serendipitous moments, do you think that maybe there's a possibility they might not have existed at all?
Are they evidence for the existence of God?
Yeah. Or maybe an exercise in soft power by some, you know, Cold War government or something.
Yeah, I mean, but then who did write... Someone wrote those songs.
It's true.
So a genius in some way existed, whether it was Lennon and McCartney or it was some sort of shady yeah. cabal or I don't quite know what.
The original Paul McCartney that they had to...
Yeah, and replace with a robot or a clone, or I never quite worked out who he was meant to have been replaced by in that conspiracy theory.
I don't think it holds much.
Avril Lavigne.
It's great, isn't it? Because that just go talk about that conspiracy theory. Whereas you think in the age we are in now, those kind of conspiracy theories. I mean, it's an obvious point to make, but they've got much worse, haven't they? You know, you look back at the 60s and you think, oh, it was a crazy time. People thought Paul McCartney was dead. And you look at our age and it's like, oh, yeah, we're 100 times worse now. We think Avril Lavigne is dead and was replaced by someone.
Paul, Avril, I mean, they're just sort of the voice of their own generation, aren't they?
Yeah. So. Yeah.
But people do. I mean, you only have to go on YouTube to see that there are people who still emphatically believe that Paul was replaced.
Really?
But then you don't really go to YouTube comment sections to get your daily news. You're in trouble if you do. Is that something you've had to deal with in your work, the current...
Conspiracy
theory. Well, conspiracy theory and, you know, fake news, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah, around drugs, there are so many... That's kind of why I set up the Say Why to Drugs podcast in the first place, was because of the sheer volume of sort of myths and misconceptions that exist around recreational drugs. And, like, I'm including alcohol and tobacco when I talk about recreational drugs, and actually some of the most interesting myths and misconceptions exist around the legal drugs, that we sort of convince ourselves that, oh no, I'm sure I saw somewhere that a glass of red wine is good for us, and that kind of thing, and around smoking and e-cigarettes has been a new one where there's a huge amount of sort of disagreement and bad faith conversations and that kind of thing. So I've got a friend, the TV presenter and actor Dallas Campbell, and he is really, really interested in conspiracy theories. And his partner is a climate scientist. So when her and I first met, we had conversations about the sort of climate science denial and the tobacco industry, and weirdly how those two things are far more related than you'd think. There's this amazing film called Merchants of Doubt, which shows that not only are the same kind of arguments being used by the tobacco industry that then started to be used in climate science denial, of like finding a sort of tame scientist to disagree so that you could say, look, the scientists don't all agree the same thing, you know, there is division here. But then when you look more closely, it's literally the same individuals and the same organizations who are kind of funding these same things. It's a book and a film, Merchants of Doubt, and it's really, really interesting. Yeah.
Wow. And how's that? And what about the conspiracies around COVID? Have you sort of encountered those? And
I did. I heard someone in the park opposite very loudly telling her friends that it was all a hoax, and that that no one's actually died of COVID. It's all been misreporting in the NHS. But it really made me laugh because she was standing 2 meters away from her friend to say all these things. It's like, well, if you don't believe it, what? You don't need to do that. So, but yeah, there's some stuff is really terrifying. Like this idea that Bill Gates wants to vaccinate us all so that I don't quite know why. Is it to put microchips in us or something like that? Or
that
to give
like
us
him.
All give us all autism? I mean, all of it is just terrifying, the sort of the things that are being sort of speculated, and how you think they're just sort of cranks and then you hear someone in the park saying the same thing, but no, it doesn't
and
exist.
It's very hard to get a grip on how widespread they are, aren't they? Because sometimes you can check Twitter and you can say, okay, there are some cranks here and there are also people being very rational. And then you look at, like, as you say, a YouTube video, and like the comments underneath are literally all the cranks or something, you know. But then, I don't know, it's sort of, it's hard to make a judgment about how many people subscribe to these things, I think.
Yeah, it's really, really hard to tell the scale of it. And also, but I think the problem is it's not a binary. It's not like you either think them or you don't. There's kind of a spectrum, and the more you hear the sort of, like, drip of... for want of a better word, fake news, then you might not think that it's the sort of Bill Gates vaccination end of it, but you might start to think it's all been a bit exaggerated and actually I probably don't need to wear a mask and I don't need to worry about going and seeing my elderly infirm relatives and that kind of thing. And
yeah.
I'm sort of, there's, yeah, there's kind of a spectrum of risk from this kind of fake news.
Well, I'm not going to ask you to provide solutions to that problem, but has anything come out of the podcast in like sort of easy wins that people can find easily?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'm really keen on doing is sort of in, like giving people the skills. So like thinking about drug use and like newspaper headlines around drugs. How do you tell whether it's based on good quality evidence or bad quality evidence? So one of the things that I like to do in the podcast is kind of talk about how something gets from a research article in like The Lancet or wherever it, to a headline in the Daily Mail. Other newspapers are available, thankfully. and, you know, so how do you tell whether something is sort of based on a really good quality source or whether the person who's writing the article has completely misunderstood it or hyped it or that kind of thing? And so having discussions about that, I think, like, I think it's something we should all be taught in school, really, this kind of critical appraisal of stuff. Like rather than in terms of science lessons, rather than teaching sort of facts and history and not history, obviously history is great, but like who, like when did a particular scientist live and die? That doesn't really matter in terms of the science. What matters is the scientific method is what we should be being taught of, like coming up with a question, trying to disprove your hypothesis and learning from that. Like we could all benefit from being more able to change our minds when presented with new evidence.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that as everything's getting more and more polarized and kind of polemic, that we're sort of forgetting how to go, oh, I hadn't thought of it like that. That's really interesting. I'm going to reassess my opinion or like,
yeah, that's not a tweet you see very often, is it?
Evidence based.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. I'll reassess that. Yeah.
So that was Dr. Susie Gage. What an amazing chat that was.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Very entertaining. Yeah, I think I realised we were talking a bit about that idea of going to Penny Lane and almost expecting to feel something, the kind of majesty of the place. And when you get to somewhere like that, I think what I was trying to explain was you get there and it's quite ordinary. Yeah. But that's the whole point of it. It is an ordinary place. It's just where he grew up. So it has the kind of magic of childhood there. But I think that's what I was trying to explain rather clumsily in the interview. That these, like Cypress Avenue, Penny Lane, are just these ordinary streets where people just happen to grow up. But because of the association with childhood, they had that magic. You know, I wasn't expecting to go to Penny Lane and for there to be a kind of fun fair and a kind of...
Although that would have been nice. That I mean, I will still... I've never been and I'm planning on a weekend in Liverpool quite soon, so I'm definitely going... We'll go and be underwhelmed.
Yeah.
Slash check it out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was the main takeaways. Penny Lane's quite boring and drugs don't really help unless you're already a musical genius.
Yeah, those are the kind of big takeaways, yeah.
But, yeah, it was a fascinating episode and thank you so much for Susie for doing it. It was really enjoyable. Her book and her podcast, Say Why to Drugs, are available now, so go and check them out. I think it's available in hardback now and it will be out in paperback later in the year, I believe. Next week, we've got another amazing guest, one of the UK's most successful songwriters with more number one hits than you could swing a cat at, Mr. Guy Chambers. Who very generously joined us now to talk about his work with Robbie Williams, writing unbelievable smash hits like Angels and Let Me Entertain You, and also producing Paul McCartney in the studio and growing up going to Quarry Bank School, where John Lennon went to school, where he had the same art teacher as John Lennon. So that is a fascinating episode coming next week too.
It was a great chat, wasn't it? And he's very, very humble and just he loves the Beatles so much. He's happy to talk to a couple of know-nothings like us, you know, and give us time, which was just brilliant, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was a very nice chat, you know.
So yeah. Do subscribe if you're not subscribed already, and just a reminder that you can rate us 5 stars if you have enjoyed the show on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow us on all of our social media channels at Personal Beatles and find any other information that you might want on personalbeatles.com.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.